This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today, we're discussing with Stephen Hayward his latest book, Patriotism is Not Enough, Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Arguments That Redefined American Conservatism. Stephen Hayward is currently the senior resident scholar at the Institute of Government Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Perhaps there'll be some interesting stories there. He also has held the visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy at the University of Colorado, Boulder. He's the author of several books, most recently, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents, From Wilson to Obama. Stephen, glad to have you on the program.
Well, thanks, Richard. I'm a longtime fan of this podcast and so thrilled and honored to be here.
Well, thank you. And I should have mentioned in your blog, although I hardly need to mention, you are the blogger of Powerline, at Powerline, one of the most visited sites on the web amongst conservatives. So great job there. You guys always have impressed me since, 2003, 2004 when I started reading.
So, well, thanks.
So the book Patriotism is Not Enough. Why did you write the book? In particular, it's a discussion of Straussian political thought amongst several thinkers in that tradition. There's a wealth of books on Leo Strauss, so why your book?
Right. Yeah, I try to do something different with this, which I'll explain second. I think first, the reason I wrote it is first the coincidence that Harry Jaffa and Walter Burns, who'd had this longtime feud, died on the same day, which is one of those extraordinary coincidences, like Jefferson and Adams dying on the same day after years of contesting each other in politics. And they're both 95 years old, and I had actually joked a few weeks before that they were each trying to outlive the other as the last act of their long feud. Right, because they're both in poor health, and I think that I'm one of very few people alive who knew both of them. A lot of people either knew one or the other, but I had been a student of Jaffa's at Claremont 30 some years ago as a graduate student, and then I was a colleague of Walter's at AEI in Washington for 10 years. And Walter was initially very wary of me because he knew where I came from and was worried that I was going to, pick fights with him because I'd been a student of Jaffa's. And I didn't do that at all. I mean, I'll say more about that fight and what was regrettable about it in due course. But became quite friendly with Walter and made me regret all the more that they had fallen into feuding. So the book is written somewhat in the form of a memoir. I tell a lot of it in the first person, which I very seldom do when I write. And I try and talk about what's most important about the two of them. I mean, I do talk about what was at the root of the feud and some of their disagreements, but I talk about why they and a wider circle of their like-minded colleagues from that era, from the 50s up to current times, represent such an important challenge to conventional political science and why they contributed in such original ways to, I think, a distinctly American conservatism. So to wrap up the sort of opening statement, I guess I'd say I've tried to write a book that does not get off into the usual esoterica of the Straussian world, which is, of course, partly about esoterica. Instead, I've tried to write a book that a general reader interested in American politics and history will find engaging and indeed even fun to read.
What do you think? I mean, what was the rock or the dividing line between Jaffa and Burns when it came to American political thought? I mean, in certain ways, you note their similarities, but what do you think most set them against one another and led to this sort of ongoing feud that lasted most of their professional lives?
Yeah, well, there were some theoretical aspects and there were some personal aspects, and I tend to talk less about the personal aspects because it's the theoretical ones that endure and are more important. I mean, Jaffa, I think, felt slighted that he wasn't included in certain bicentennial observances in the 70s and 80s, but as I say, that's a minor detail, I think. I think one of the core elements of the argument is about what kind of country America is. Is it a wholly modern liberal country, or does it have some aspects of classical republicanism, some inclusion of the ideas of individual virtue and civic virtue, the way Plato and Aristotle would have understood it? In other words, it really came down to how should John Locke be understood, since we think of Locke as America's philosopher. That's what Burns and others called him. And so a lot of that can be sort of theoretical and maybe not of much interest to an awful lot of conservatives or anybody else. But in fact, you know, if America is purely a modern liberal country organized wholly around self-interest, even if we say self-interest rightly understood, then it's less admirable than a country that has some core idea to it, something about some ideas of greatness and of virtue that the country tries to inculcate. And that's an argument that other people have had besides just Jaffe and Burns, but that's one of their falling outs they had. They generally agreed about Lincoln, but managed to find ways to fight about that too, unfortunately.
Thinking about this dispute over Locke, I mean, in both men formed by Leo Strauss.
Right.
Leo Strauss famously very critical of John Locke and very critical of his influence on modern liberalism, seeing it as the famous statement from Leo Strauss: Locke gave us the joyless quest for joy, or what we might think of as middle class hedonism, the constant pursuit of new technological gratification, working merely to appease yourself, things like that. So both men, I take it, are pushing against that in various ways, not inclined to wholly accept Strauss's very negative understanding of Strauss.
I think Burns was closer to Strauss's view, although I think he moved away from it somewhat. And I actually think that if they'd lived on longer or whatever, I think they would have converged a bit. And I think you can make out ways they converged a bit very late in life. Jaffa subscribed to Strauss's view of Locke for a very long time and changed his mind about it. And that's part of the story I try and tell. Jaffa invented what some people have called — Jaffa didn't use this phrase, but people have said that he tried to discover Lockestottle, or the fusion of Locke and Aristotle. Jaffa did actually write, and I quoted in the book, that Locke is what Aristotle would have become if Aristotle had been writing in the 18th century. That's a very controversial proposition and maybe not entirely persuasive. I think it's not wholly persuasive, but it is interesting and something to work with. And Burns for a long time didn't go along with that, but I think he changed his mind a little bit. Part of it was, I do tell the story of Burns and his very bitter experience at Cornell in 1969.
Yeah,
there when you had the black radicals took over the school at gunpoint, and essentially threatened Burns' life, right? He had to move his family to a hotel out of his neighborhood, literally in fear of his life, right? And then he and Alan Bloom resigned in protest of the administration caving into the radicals. And then, I think it's very dramatic and explains a lot about Burns personally. He and Bloom went off to the University of Toronto. And for Burns, who was, a patriot in the ordinary sense of, he signed up for the Navy in 1941 before Pearl Harbor. He said, "I just knew we had to take a side in this fight, and I knew what side I wanted to be on." So for him, this was exile from the country he loved, and it made him very pessimistic and very gloomy. And, one of the things that upset him so much is that some of his own students were part of the student mob. And he got to reflecting later that some of those students may have taken to heart too much some of Burns' own teachings about the sort of selfish defects of the American founding as the standard Straussian account of Locke held in mind. I think that shocked him a bit and sobered him some and worried him a bit. Because, of course, he didn't mean to teach that the country was contemptible in the way the student left it in the 60s. That's not his intention at all. So by degrees, I think why Burns came to spend more time thinking about Lincoln. Late in his life, from the 80s on, Burns wrote about Lincoln in almost exactly the same way that Jaffa did. It's really this sort of central figure in restoring and vindicating the American founding.
Thinking about Jaffa here and Burns and their dispute about how to think about the Constitution, you have two diametrically opposed quotes, I think, on how they thought about the Constitution.
Yeah.
Coming through the art of judging, or what judges are supposed to do. And Jaffa says everybody brings to the Constitution principles from outside the text that he uses to lead it in a certain direction. And Burns seems to push against that. And maybe you can discuss this more. Burns may be much more willing or inclined to look inside principles like federalism, separation of powers, that are embodied within the text, and maybe much more willing to allow representation, congressional self-government to move, whereas Jaffa is really looking at the Declaration of Independence, by which we would understand the Constitution. Talk about maybe that you know, controversy between them.
Oh, yeah, that's a fascinating story, and also something I sort of discovered new dimensions to in doing research for this. You know, Jaffa is very much of the view that the natural law teaching of the Declaration of Independence should be a source of you know, active jurisprudence in the Supreme Court and their decisions. In that respect, he aligns with Clarence Thomas or maybe George Sutherland from a century ago. And Burns was very much of the same view of Robert Bork and, I think, Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, that we should be much more textual literalists, that we should not go beyond the text into the sort of philosophical intentions or dimensions. And Burns was, as I say, very much of that view, but he changed his mind on that. I mean, I had not read a lot of Burns' early work from the 50s when he first started out, and I was startled to discover his first book called Freedom, Virtue, and the First Amendment. I mean, there's a funny thing right there. There's virtue in the title, saying the Supreme Court's not concerned enough about the importance of virtue. And he makes a number of comments along the way in that book about the importance of what would have been called, or sometimes called today, conservative substantive due process. And you go, huh, that's interesting. That sounds similar to what Jaffa says today. And someone, it wasn't me, someone asked Burns about this later, when he later in the 80s was writing about how, you know, natural law, natural rights have no place in jurisprudence. And Walter, in his typical gruff, deep voice, said, "I changed my mind." You know, he had that great, deep baritone voice. And my speculation on this, because I never thought to ask Walter about this, because I was, as I say, unaware of these early writings. My speculation on this is that as the predations of the war in court got rolling along in the 60s and the 70s and beyond, I think he began to worry, from simply a matter of pure prudence, which I think is entirely comprehensible, that opening the door for conservatives to open the door to extra-constitutional philosophy was, although we have strong arguments in that regard, it was a game that ultimately favors the left, because they're much more inventive in creating new rights and importing them into the Constitution, and that the only effective practical bulwark against that was to retreat to a more you know, textually based interpretive framework. And I think that was the divide on jurisprudence between Jaffa and Burns. But we see it today. The same argument is going along between certain libertarian thinkers, you know, like Epstein and Richard Barnett, for example, and a lot of other conservative jurists who say, no, who are really, I think, the heirs of Bork and Burns, saying, no, that's a mistake. We should be much more cautious and stick to the text.
Yeah, it's interesting in this regard, too. So, Jaffa, I mean, and I think, you know, really getting somewhat into the weeds, I mean, it's interesting to look at Randy Barnett, our Institute for Justice lawyers, those who write in public print, not just as lawyers, seem to have a conception, though, of individual rights that's very autonomistic in a way in which I think Jaffa would not have gone to that degree. I think Jaffa never really lost sight of a connection between rights and virtue or never thought that there was some sort of clear separation there. In terms of it being just a matter of will. He was trying to provide really a philosophical grounding for rights that was much more robust. That's something that I think is evident here. But it's interesting in this regard. So many of Harry Jaffa's students and students of students now trying to bring a rather robust philosophical defense of maybe the populist conservatism we're seeing, obviously, with the election of Donald Trump. And yet it is interesting, many natural rights defenders now are interesting, with Randy Barnett and others in the, you know, judicial engagement school. And it's, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I've been on sort of both sides of that question and wrote a long article in the Weekly Standard back in October, scratching my head, puzzling about how especially the Claremont friends of mine, and I, you know, I am one of those guys to a large extent because I went to Claremont. They were fascinated, many of them, and have been defending Donald Trump rather stoutly. And I wondered, to borrow that Straussian phrase, do they understand Trump better than Trump understands himself? Because, you know, if you think about statesmen, the progression of names, you know, Lincoln, Churchill, Trump, doesn't quite follow, right? There's no sort of theoretical depth to Trump at all.
As Jonah Goldberg said, Jonah Goldberg said, there's this idea of, and therefore Trump. We have XYZ, and therefore Trump. Yeah.
Right. I do think that now there is some of the argument I think is coherent and defensible, and you know, I do have a chapter that bears on this. Although I finished the book before Trump was nominated, so Trump doesn't really figure into the book. I stuck in a couple of mentions late in the final revisions, but I don't try and treat the Trumpian phenomenon. But there is this problem, that's what I wrote about in the Weekly Standard article, is that we've come to a point where elections almost don't change our government much anymore. The people don't really control the government anymore. This is, you know, one aspect of what we, you and other guests of yours talk about, the problem of the administrative state.
Yeah.
More and more independent power lodged in an unaccountable fourth branch of government. And so part of the argument about Trump as a disruptor, it's not just a disruptor of political correctness and some of the other things that have been talked about, but that he's the one person who might actually disrupt this whole momentum of the administrative state. I think that remains to be seen, of course, all things do. That's the old cliche about any new president. But he does seem more clear on that problem than anybody, with the possible exception of Ted Cruz, who I think understands that problem in some profound way. But he didn't win. We have Trump. And so I don't know. We'll see if Trump really understands that or if he's just going to be another improvisational person like his tweets.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, think about the title of your book, Patriotism is Not Enough. And this connection with some of the Claremont writers defending Trump or in various ways defending Trump, there was something there, an acknowledgement in Trump that here there might be, as you were saying, a fundamental break that would perhaps permit self-government to reemerge and perhaps permit sort of a patriotism that many, you know, as Wilmore Kendall, another figure in your book, would say there was a patriotism in the Americans between the two mountain ranges that was just good and solid, and you could depend on that. And
right.
this may be what Trump could unlock, best possible interpretation.
You know, there are so many paradoxes and surprises in history that you could be this sort of inarticulate man of no fixed principle.
Yeah.
Might oddly
right.
enough be a vehicle for renewal of certain areas that, you know, we intellectuals always look for someone with an intellectual quotient, like, you know, Ronald Reagan had some of that, right? And so, you know, maybe we'll be surprised about all of this. But, sort of lost my train of thought here. But we've reached a point now where, you know, we got to try something new and disruptive. I think Jaffa would have liked Trump.
Oh, really? Now, that's interesting. Because I've often thought, what would Harry Jaffa say about his students? He wouldn't be pleased. So this is interesting.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not certain about it. I'm quite certain that Walter Burns would have intensely disliked Trump. I can cite passages from Burns's writing to that effect. Jaffa, though, the reason I think that about Jaffa is that, remember that he was, and I have a chapter about this in the book, he was big for Barry Goldwater long before most other people in the Straussian circle certainly weren't for Goldwater. They were shocked by Jaffa's affiliation with Goldwater. And what Jaffa liked about Goldwater was precisely his disruptive capacities, not just for liberalism, but also for the Republican Party. So that's a hunch on my part. I don't know that.
Yeah.
But I also think you mentioned Wilmore Kendall. I think Kendall might have liked Trump for
reason. I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Interesting here, you mentioned the Goldwater campaign. Another conservative, I don't know, theorist, we could call him historian, man of letters, Russell Kirk, also engaged in the Barry Goldwater campaign. Kind of brings to mind a question coming from the subtitle of your book, The Arguments That Redefine American Conservatism. How do you find, or how did Jaffa and Burns find American conservatism? And did they both think, Jaffa, yes, I think, that it needed a bigger, deeper theoretical apparatus?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll say just a couple things about Kirk, who I mentioned briefly in the book, if you take Kirk's most famous book, The Conservative Mind, I think it's not unfair to say, I usually don't like to use that double negative formulation, but I don't want to be too strong on this, but it really could be called the European conservative mind, right? I mean, he's very strong on Burke, of course, and that's fine. But, you know, that book is very light on American conservative thought, with the exception of literary figures. In other words, he skips over Madison and Jefferson completely in the book, you know, maybe a couple of brief mentions of Lincoln. Kirk's later work was quite different. I think The Roots of American Order, they wrote in the 1970s, is a better book and is much more about the American tradition, and I think is a complement to the conservative mind. But I think Jaffa and Burns and other people like them said, wait a minute, there are perfectly good American sources, especially the people in the founding, who we often have called liberals, right? Sort of Madisonian liberalism, so to speak. And that tradition needed to be made more robust, especially since the liberals, starting with the progressives 100 years ago, had set out to repudiate or render that whole school of thought obsolete. And so that's part of what they did. I think not alone. I mean, I mentioned Martin Diamond, you know, other figures. Herbert Storing, I think, was an important figure in this same body of work, who all you know, reinvigorated the idea that there were things in the American tradition that would make for a robust American conservatism. And I'll say that both Jaffa and also Burns, this is one thing they were united about, didn't care for Russell Kirk very much. In fact, Walter Burns back in the 50s wrote a very harsh review of, I don't think it was a conservative mind, I don't remember now, but there was some other thing that Kirk had written that Burns wrote very sarcastically and harshly about.
Yeah, that and the famous article by Wilmore Kendall, The Sage of Macosta. Hard to live down, though it does seem to be, particularly with the roots of the American order, Russell Kirk seemed to have an understanding of America as sort of a culmination or a distillation of the wisdom of the West.
Right.
And as he says that, and so this is, so there is, and one of the thinkers he profiles in the conservative mind that I'm trying to revive discussion about, Orestes Bronson, this idea of an unwritten foundation, a small C constitution that we actually have to find ways to keep alive and keep in contact with political discussion in order to actually ground ourselves constitutionally. I suppose Jaffa would think, no, the unwritten is the Declaration of Independence and those natural rights principles, whereas I think Russell Kirk would say, no, I don't disagree with the natural rights principles. I do abhor the Enlightenment methodology that undergirds them.
Right. I think that that's a very fair characterization of it. I had one other thing that, you know, Kirk, and this is you know, not to his discredit entirely, but he was very apolitical or didn't like politics very much. And, you know, he did not enjoy his association with the Goldwater campaign. And we wanted to withdraw from politics somewhat after all that. And that, I think, makes some difference from people like Jaffa and Burns and the others who are very intensely involved and interested in politics. And even when they lost, as in the case of Goldwater, didn't diminish their ardor for participating in the public square. You know, Kirk really, I think, was more at home writing his, you know, Gothic horror stories and poetry and thinking about philosophy and literary figures. And I say, I think that's fine and useful and very inspirational to a lot of students, but it does leave the political field, you know, vacant. So I think that's one area, you know, worthy of discussion and possible criticism.
No, and you see, I mean, a lot of people, I think, really take Russell Kirk seriously, writing at the Front Porch Republic. Seem also to have this sort of apolitical motivation.
Yeah.
And they have sort of a canon of thinkers that they appeal to. Interesting in this respect, you know, Russell Kirk said that Brad Berzer, in his new biography of Russell Kirk, says that Kirk never really recovered from his affiliation with the Goldwater campaign in terms of having the sort of independent conservative voice where he would, you know, find appeals in the New York Times and other major media publications of the period, when really there were Americans were reading about three or four publications, you know.
Right.
I mean, so, and that's interesting, and, you know, maybe what, interesting what Kirk might have taken from that. Thinking about politics here, a term that's in your book and something you discuss at length is statesmanship. Both Jaffa and Burns took the notion and the practice of statesmanship very seriously, dismissed, as you note in the book, widely by social science and modern political science for various reasons, and it also, in a way, as you say, sets them apart from a lot of Straussian thinkers, particularly East Coast Straussian thinkers, who themselves don't consider this to be a source of wisdom or a element of virtue that can be readily appealed to and discussed.
Yeah, a lot to that. I mean, I'll sort of work backwards from the way you framed it. An awful lot of the Strauss circle put the emphasis more on philosophy than the political part of political philosophy. You know, Seth Bernadetti, for example. Now, I think that's perfectly fine. The question of statesmanship, though, which I think really can be traced back to Strauss's own interests and inclinations, is, well, I'll put it this way. Jaffa writes, and Burns said much the same thing, is the way Jaffa put it was, the proper method for the study of politics is the speeches and deeds of great statesmen. In other words, they take our bearings from the best and highest and most important, and even often imperfect people, right? I mean, that's why we read Machiavelli and Xenophon, but also study Lincoln and Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, for that matter. But, you know, in the age of scientific politics, which is now, you know, a very old idea, but it gets worse and worse all the time, we think the only true knowledge is narrowly empirical knowledge of, you know, that we get out of regression analysis and models and things of that kind. And I think we teach students, or actually we misteach students, because we become moral and political illiterates about what the world, real world of politics is actually like. So, you know, I quote Ed Banfield, who, you know, was somewhat influenced by Strauss, who said, "Does anyone think that the founders in Philadelphia in 1787 would have done a better job if they'd had a whole staff of model builders with them to, you know, run regressions and the way we go about political science these days?" But no, I mean, the problem now is if a student walks into a political science department anywhere and says, "Gosh, I'd like to study statesmanship," people will think they're being crazy. Today, instead, the
we would need a new term. At the least.
There's the problem. To the extent it's studied at all, we now get leadership. And most of the sort of so-called leadership.
Global leadership.
Oh, that's worse, of course. But, you know, it gets reduced to, you know, it's very content-free, I think. It's all sort of form and no substance, and it's all rather pathetic stuff, I think. But yeah, and you see it in business schools and, you know, all kinds of places. But no, one of things burns. In fact, the very last conversation I ever had with Walter was over the telephone because he was at home then and, you know, was in a wheelchair, really. But he said, I'll try to do his voice again, "The proper method for the study of politics is biography."
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I have taught a couple of classes where I said our principal reading material is going to be good biographies of real people. And that includes, by the way, I'm a big fan, for example, of the Robert Carroll biographies of Lyndon Johnson. I think, you know, Carroll has many defects, but as terms of a rich biography where you can learn a lot by studying and thinking closely about what Lyndon Johnson was doing as a senator and so forth, you can learn a lot about political life that you won't get from another class in methodology.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I just visited Abraham Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois, and for some reason punished myself by taking the official tour. And, you know, the official tour was sort of a progressive Lincoln. And I remember at the end it was, we are all working for the equality Lincoln promised and believed in. And if we do that, we keep alive Lincoln. And that sort of brings to mind a discussion, a criticism of Lincoln, particularly that the equality itself is a problem. And he easily blends into being a progressive figure. I know you have an answer for that. Jeff obviously did. But that it also sort of this ways in which liberal democracy has a hard time thinking about statesmanship precisely because it's so fearful of distinction and rank and merit and actually looking at something and saying, well, that was actually excellent judgment. And history could have gone an entirely different way. But we all know history is going in one way, a progressive way.
Right. Yeah, no, that's one of the problems with statesmanship is exactly that, is it implicitly, actually explicitly, holds up an idea of human excellence and wisdom that runs against our egalitarian sensibilities. That's another of the ideological reasons, in addition to the methodological reasons, that the idea is not taken seriously anymore. There's that. You also mentioned the whole problem of equality. I say, you know, Jaffa had answers that I tend to agree with, but I think they're not sufficient or have problems, right? I mean, I'm not uncritical of Jaffa in this book, I think. I mean, I don't know what you thought from reading it, but you know, the problem of equality has always been, as you know, Tocqueville, I think, maybe was the first to point out, is that it would get out of control, right, to put it in modern terms. And you know, that's the problem these days, is how do you confine this to some sensible dimensions, the way it was understood by, say, Madison? And, you know, that's been the story of conservatism's erosion for decades, is the inability to accomplish that very well. And so while on the level of ideas, you know, Jaffa's scheme for this, I think, is very good, as a practical matter, it's still very problematic for our side.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too. I mean, I've often wondered if what Jaffa most loved about the Declaration of Independence really can't be justified by the best of Enlightenment liberalism. It has to really be understood maybe through the Puritan experience in America and Puritan anthropology and Puritan theology. That is to say, it's this distinctiveness of the human person under God that really brings to life the Declaration of Independence in the American experience and makes it something worthy of our devotion, not something just philosophical.
Well, I think there's that, although, you know, I think in Jaffa's case, it's actually something more personal, and I didn't talk about this very much in the book because it's somewhat speculative, but, you know, he did tell the story, and I think I mentioned this in the book, that, you know, when he was getting ready to graduate from Yale as an undergraduate, I think around 1939 or 1940, he told his principal advisor, Harvey Mansfield Sr., interestingly enough, was his advisor at Yale, and said, gosh, I think I want to go to graduate school and become a, you know, professor. And Mansfield told him, that's a very bad idea, and the simple reason is that you're Jewish, and, you know, Jews just don't get hired much, right? I mean, that really was back in the days when, you know, the Ivy League schools and elsewhere had quotas to keep, to limit the number of Jews who were admitted. And, you know, I think that's one reason why Jaffa had such sympathy for the civil rights movement, rightly understood, and why he grasped onto Lincoln and Lincoln's teaching on equality. I mean, I think there's merit in the theoretical account of it that he gives, but I also think there was the personal dimension that appealed to him there, because he understood from firsthand experience what it meant to be treated unequally because of your ethnicity.
So, and he looked to the natural rights, and he also looked to, that might also explain the, what you report in the book, the fascination with the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
That's a story that's been told some, but I retell it, that, you know, he just stumbled across a book that was, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates in a secondhand bookshop while he was a graduate student and became fascinated with it. And that was at a time when, and I also retell this, I mean, he's done it some, but I've added some, I think, some new things or additional things to that story, that the historiography of Lincoln by mid-century, the consensus liberal era, people like Lewis Hartz and Arthur Schlesinger and James Randall and so forth, was really very flabby. They didn't take the Lincoln-Douglas debate seriously, didn't think anything important was going on there. And so not only painted an inadequate picture of what was at stake in the debates about the principles of the country in the 1850s, but then also distorted and diminished our appreciation and understanding of Lincoln.
Thinking about that, so you talk about that too, sort of a liberal consensus tradition, not taking first principles or even the idea of first principles that seriously, trying to, in effect, keep America united around, I'm not exactly sure. It wasn't certainly the founding in a robust philosophical sense, but something else, something like American intentions going forward, democratic consensus, building peacefulness, something like that.
Yeah, well, I have a whole chapter on that whole era of so-called consensus liberalism of the late 40s and into the 50s, and, you know, names now that are somewhat forgotten, or that actually a lot of, you know, people on the left today have openly rejected, but, you know, it would be Schlesinger and Hartz and Hofstadter and so forth. And, you know, Jaffa actually, of course, the thing to remember about Jaffa and Burns and most of the people around Strauss in the 50s is that they were Democrats and thought of themselves as liberals for the most part. And so they, you know, a lot of Jaffa's early writing, he's actually very complimentary of Hofstadter, at least. I don't think he took much account of Schlesinger, but he was critical of Hartz and Hartz's liberal tradition in America. They were once on a panel together in the late 50s that didn't go very well. I think by degrees, you know, as Jaffa's own views evolved, he realized what was defective and superficial about so much of that work. And I've tried to recapture that and add some to all that. My interpretation is that the mid-century liberals, like Schlesinger being the most famous, I think, I think they understood, even as Franklin Roosevelt understood a little bit, that the progressivism of Woodrow Wilson and Herbert Crowley and people of that kind actually went too far in deprecating the American founding. I think partly World War II and you know, totalitarianism had something to do with that, because, you know, that was a phenomenon that Wilson and the other progressives never anticipated or would have thought plausible at all. But what they repaired to was a very gauzy and, I think, they say, superficial and lightweight account of American Madisonian liberalism. It was sort of a belief in the efficacy of the tradition, but without much serious engagement with the depths of it in any philosophical way. And that's what I think Jaffa and Burns and, you know, Martin Diamond and as I say, that wider circle of people perceived and realized was inadequate about you know, the liberalism that they were part of at the time. And that's when they started moving, I think, to the right.
Interesting here in this regard, also writing at this time, starting to, in a big way, Wilmore Kendall, a figure you discuss in the book, who has a strong disagreement with Harry Jaffa over Lincoln and equality. Now, at one level, so Kendall thinks Lincoln could become sort of the standard that certain presidents will always try to fulfill if we keep talking him up and the manner in which Jeff is doing. But there's also a disagreement about also equality. Kendall doesn't think you can philosophically limit equality or give it sort of that solid definition Jaffa does that would keep it from, you know, being defined by a progressive understanding. But there's also maybe the most important part of that discussion, I think, is particularly even for right now, is Kendall insists that the locus of virtue in the American constitutional tradition is actually in the people.
Right.
And a lot of articles, a famous article on building congressional majorities versus building presidential majorities and why presidential majorities lead to things that conservatives don't like by the very nature of how they're formed versus the concrete, particular, bounded congressional majority. And he also believes that this allows for compromise, waiver, and you know, sort of the give and take discussion that constitutionalism should facilitate, and which he thinks is at the heart of the Federalist Papers. It seems, I mean, just thinking now, and we've kind of touched on this with the administrative state and Trump, that to the extent there's a hope for conservatism in America in a robust way, it's probably more with Kendall in that position than maybe it is with sort of the endless discussion defense of natural rights that Jaffa attempted.
Yeah, boy, that is, you know, I'm half tempted to write a whole separate book on what you just said. Again, one of the things I discovered along the way in doing research and thinking about this book is that Jaffa's feud with Burns was really, in a lot of ways, a proxy feud with Kendall, who had died by the 1970s. What Kendall died, 1970, 71?
I think it was like 64, 65.
Oh, was it that early? And he's only 67 years old, is that right?
Well, I don't know if he was that old. I mean, he, you know, as you know, had a problem with alcohol and I think just set his health back tremendously, yeah.
Yeah, well, here's what I mean. My counterfactual or you know thought experiment is if Kendall had lived on 15, 20 more years, he and Jaffa would have had the epic clash. But see, I think Jaffa wasn't paying attention to where Kendall was going in the late 60s. And, of course, you know, Jaffa did attack Kendall rather ferociously by the late 70s and the 80s, but Kendall wasn't around to respond in person.
Yeah.
And in a certain respect, same with Martin Diamond, who died, what, I think at age 49 of a heart attack in 1975, yeah. Right?
I think
so. So Jaffa was picking on dead people. And I think Burns, one account I've heard of this I think is right, is that Burns, although he admitted the substance of a lot of Jaffa's points, was angry. Jeremy Rapkin put it this way to me. He said that Burns was sticking with his friends. Against attacks, some of them very personal and you know, maybe they went too far from Jaffa against people who were not there to defend themselves. I think there's something to all that. But, you know, I read that that book about Kendall that what John Murley and who is it? I've got here. John Murley and John Alvis put together a few years ago.
Oh, the correspondence?
And in the appendix, what's that?
The correspondence?
Yeah, the correspondence between
Kendall
between,
and Strauss.
Yeah, and some of that's very interesting because what you see in there is hints of Kendall saying, essentially, I'll paraphrase here, I hugely respect Jaffa and think he's a genius, but I think there are problems here, and I think I want to take him on. And I think that's where Kendall was going. And, you know, the famous posthumous book, Basic Symbols of the American Political Tradition, where Kendall argues that Lincoln had derailed the American political tradition rightly understood, I think was really aimed at Jaffa, although Jaffa's not mentioned in that book at all. And I don't think Jaffa read it until after Kendall had died.
Okay.
And, you know, I think the point you make about what is the locus of a sound political order, is it going to be in statesmen and a theoretical account of natural rights and the teaching of the founding, or is it going to be in the virtue of the people and also in the representative branches of government? I think that's an extremely worthy argument, and gosh, I wish Kendall had lived long enough to have that out in Jaffa. With Jaffa and others in a way that I think we need to revive that argument. And as you say, maybe Trump in an odd way is going to make us do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting if we think of, say, the judicial engagement theorist. I mean, it seems I have a hard time wrapping my mind around, even though I tend to agree with them on a lot of points, but the notion that the federal judiciary is going to cure us of the administrative state by getting rid of the Chevron doctrine or our deference or you know, in a way, sort of reaching in and pulling back certain economic regulations, and making it harder for local jurisdictions to pass licensing statutes, things like that.
Right.
It seems a little piecemeal to me, and to really, but I think more foundationally, it just dismisses politics as a vital human activity of a republic.
Oh, I am in heated agreement with what you just said. I mean, we've been talking about getting the court to turn around for, you know, at least since Nixon, right? We're going to have strict constructionist judges and originalists and all that. And I'm for all those things. I mean, it would be a good thing to do. But, yeah, this idea that we're going to turn around the judiciary and reverse a century's worth of decay in our constitutional character, I think is completely wrongheaded. But it's of a piece with the something I always complain about and do this a lot with students. It's of a piece with the view that the Constitution is purely a legal document or the province of lawyers and judges, right? That's always been a mistake. I always like to say the preamble doesn't begin we the lawyers or we the judges. It begins we the people. And we need to take that more seriously. And again, in an odd way, Trump may understand that in some elemental way that he'll never be able to articulate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in this regard, too. If one thinks about a Madisonian originalism, a Madisonian originalism would seem to allow the people to, through debate, through ongoing election victories, define the meaning of constitutional terms. I mean, there's, you know, it's not discussed enough. There's a great, I think it's used maybe three times in the Federalist Papers, this idea of liquidating the meaning of the Constitution, which
right.
is mentioned. And, you know, it seems that you could actually come to better, more popularly approved of meanings of the Constitution in that process. Where, you know, what do we think of an unlimited abortion regime or the prospect of legalizing abortion? Well, let's see how the elections go. Let's see how debates go in different ways. And that sort of gives us a sense of where this should shake out, as opposed to a 5-vote majority on the justice, you know, on the Supreme Court, which is where we are now.
Right, right. You know, it's funny you should mention Madison in that context. I was just yesterday, for the first time in almost 30 years, I think, reading the speech that Madison gave at the convention in Philadelphia on June 6th, but it's very early in the convention. You may know it or remember it. And that's when they were starting to argue about you know, the House of Representatives. Should it be appointed by the state legislatures? You know, should we have some scheme? You know, they had a lot of people saying, we don't want to have them directly elected. And then Madison gets up and gives a long speech. He's very long in his notes, even, and he says, no, the lower house should be elected directly by the people, and then he goes on to lay out the argument. By the way, it's a preview of Federalist 10 in some parts of it, but he makes the argument about why it needs to be connected to the people, why there needs to be a popular element to the government, even as we have the Senate appointed, you know, by legislatures and so forth. And that, you know, that really changed the whole course of, I mean, that was a decisive intervention on his part in changing the course of the convention, which otherwise might have gone with some goofy scheme of having members of Congress selected by state legislatures instead of by elections of the people.
Yeah, no, but interesting, too, to think about just the idea of what type of arguments you could have if Congress is actually, because it seems to be also in the Federalist Papers, all branches are equal, but Congress is really equal. And
right.
what type of system we have where that is put into play. But then, of course, in the back of my mind, I'm hearing Adrian Vermeule. We just reviewed his book on Law and Liberty, that somehow on postmodern democratic conditions really can't handle a robust legislature. We actually need, I guess it's sort of a historicist argument, we actually need the administrative state to handle all of the inputs of an incredibly rich, you know, diverse populist society.
Yeah, you know, that's a pretty, you know, in the abstract, that's a pretty good argument. I mean, I sometimes ask our libertarian friends a question, like a particular question, that goes something like this. Okay, of course the Food and Drug Administration does a terrible job of regulating and approving new drugs, and there's lots of things wrong. On the other hand, what's the actual alternative? Do we actually want members of Congress voting on drug approval? I don't think we'd want that. Is the idea of common law liability really a practical substitute in an era of the internet where people will hawk, you know, phony stuff that might even be dangerous for you? I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. On the other hand, to step back and now take it from a very broad view instead of a narrow question like that, I wonder if what we're seeing with Brexit. I remember all the predictions about Brexit that, oh, my God, it's going to trash the British economy. It's going to ruin everything. And, you know, what's happened in the aftermath is the pound is up. The British economy is doing well. And we're starting to – I think maybe we have reached, again, with Trump, an emperor's new clothes moment for that argument. Well, of course, there's a necessity for some technical expertise in an administrative way. But we've carried that so far, and it's become – I wonder if we're not now seeing – possibly an emperor's new clothes moment where we realize that it's all, maybe not a fraud, but that actually we can get by with an awful lot, we think.
Yeah, I know. In this regard, too, I mean, many people are now making the argument renewed, I think, for a congressional regulatory office.
Right.
That, you know, either, you know, maybe it competes with these executive or has more authority itself. And of course, it also, I mean, it's interesting. If you think about another way, most of the wealth has not yet been created. We have no idea what's coming with drones, artificial technology, et cetera. But that, of course, then brings about, okay, does that mean most of the regulations haven't been written yet? And how do we want to slice that? Do we actually want it to be co-equal in terms of business and regulatory, or actually lead more in the direction of letting businesses and maybe more spontaneous ways of ordering that develop, private licensing regimes, et cetera, being willing to try that as opposed to more and more administrative power. And now it seems quasi-administrative power.
Right. And you know, I have no idea how to sort all that out. Yeah. I mean, I like things like the RAINS Act that have been proposed of making Congress vote on large regulations. But, that famous phrase that's attributed either to Marx or Saint-Simon or others that Jaffa used to talk about a lot in class. You'll know it. The goal of modern politics is for the government of men to be replaced by the administration of things. And that's a very insidious idea, right? And I think the present moment represents a turning back of that on the philosophical level, and I'm hopeful the practical details will follow.
Yeah, what do you think overall, looking back and thinking about conservatism in America, and maybe even just higher than that, the study of political science properly understood, Jaffa and Burns, what's their lasting mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think their lasting mark is to, and I put this early in the book, is that they explain. Well, I say patriotism is not enough. That's a phrase Jaffa used to use, and Burns agreed with. That's why I took it as the title of the book. They explain why we should love America, not just because it's our country and it's our homeland. I mean, that's fine. But they make the argument that this is a just country and a good country, full stop, right? You know, the modern left, of course, it's all racist, sexism, terrible oppression all the way down, right? They provide us with the reasons for refuting that modern liberal and leftist narrative in a very rich way. I think that's the most important part. They also inspire students, I think, right?
Yeah.
Not just them, but professors like them, I think, offer an opening into understanding political life that's just so much more rich and inspirational than learning 15 different refinements of regression analysis. And for that, I think we'll always want teachers like them.
Yeah, no, I spoke one time at the Ashbrook Center. You're familiar with the Ashbrook Center.
Oh, yeah, pretty much so.
I remember getting there and the sort of, mesmerizing hold that Peter Schramm had on his students, as we walked in and he spoke and introduced me, and I thought, this is really a testimony to his teaching ability, his charisma, all of these things, and it's because he tries to argue for things that are true.
Right.
And that commands respect amongst young people. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the program and discussing your book, Patriotism Is Not Enough. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Richard.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.